morning, brethren. Today I want to return to a topic I've spoken on, at least a couple of times before, over the last, I guess that's 5 or 10 years now, is quite an important topic. In fact, I guess really a very important topic, but also one which is very, very practical, because it affects our conduct throughout our waking hours. I want to look again, as once or twice before, at our words, how we use our tongues, whether we use them for good or bad, for blessing or cursing, for life or death. Because, you see, if we don't learn to use our words properly, the way God instructs us, then our words, our mouth, our tongue can harm both us and harm other people, or bless us and bless other people. If you think about it, the ability to speak, to communicate in words, really is a godly attribute. I mean, animals and birds and fish sort of communicate to a degree, you know, barks and squeaks and honks and quacks and whatnot, but it is very basic by comparison to us as human beings, and the various range of topics and knowledge and moods and thoughts and dreams that we can communicate. So our ability to speak, to use words, really is a godly characteristic. Unfortunately, there is a tendency for us to be rather careless with our words. We fail too often to realize the importance of controlling our words and choosing our words, and Scripture has an awful lot to say about that. So today's message will be the first of at least two, maybe three. I've entitled it Guard Your Lips, and amazingly this is called Part 1. So Guard Your Lips, Part 1. Let's introduce it by turning to Proverbs 18:21. Proverbs chapter 18 and verse 21. And here we read in Proverbs 18 and in verse 21, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruit. So we take the scripture as it's written. It says that life and death, or death and life, are in the power of the tongue. Well, that sounds to me like the tongue is quite important, is quite influential, if indeed the tongue has the power of life and death. Now, those would be probably the extremes, but in between death and life there's a lot of encouragement or a lot of despair brought about by our tongue. The words that we use, I think it's fairly evident to all of us that words can be encouraging. Words can build us up, can build up and inspire other people. If you think about it, preaching the Word of God brings life, brings hope, brings truth. And equally, of course, we know the opposite is also true, that words can discourage, can hurt people, can break up families, can destroy careers. Words can drive some people to despair and to suicide. So, at the extreme, yeah, our words, your words, in fact, your words, according to Scripture, have the power of life and death. And it says here, those who love it will eat its fruit. There is fruit from our words. Our words do produce. They can produce good, and they can produce bad, and you and I will often eat the fruit of our own lips. One of the translations translates this verse as, life and death are in the power of the tongue, and they that rule it shall eat the fruits thereof. I quite like that. That implies that you and I should be able to rule our tongue, to rule our words, to choose our words carefully. And then, of course, if we choose our words carefully and wisely, the fruit that we produce will be good fruit, upbuilding fruit, fruit of life. And we probably all can think of times in the past when we've said some rather good things and encouraged ourselves and others, and equally we've been a bit careless and didn't think too much and blurted out something that we've seen perhaps harm done. Now hopefully in most cases the harm can be healed, but sometimes it is too late. Sometimes we open our mouths and speak and it's done, and you can't unravel it, and that can be harmful. I remember some years back, probably 20 years ago, there was quite a famous jewelers chain in Britain called Ratner's, and the guy who was chairman was Gerald Ratner. It was a family company, and in all parts of Britain, all the cities, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, London, wherever, you would find high streets with Ratner's jewelers. And fairly economical. They weren't highly priced, but you'd get their, you know, rings and earrings and nose rings and belly button rings and whatever else you want to buy, and candelabras and port glasses and sherry glasses and so on. And once at a private function, just to show you the importance of words, it was private apparently, but there were some people there that took his comments away and leaked them to the press. But he said something, I believe it was supposed to be in good humour, and said something like, how come our goods are so cheap in our shops? And he said, excuse the language, because they are total crap. I wouldn't repeat that, but that's what he said. But it was repeated, and amazingly, within about a week, the word was out, and the value of that business dropped by £500 million. That's about roughly nearly $1 billion. Because of the man's words. It almost went bankrupt, and in fact Mr. Gerald Ratner was thrown out within a few months because words, a few careless words, and it destroyed, in a sense, his future, his destiny, destroyed his company, destroyed the livelihoods of many, many, many people who served in the shops and shop managers, and of course hugely disappointed people who were owners of Ratner's jewellery. I heard on the news that it was total, etc. So, yeah, words can be important. And you think about it, the scripture says death and life. Well, death and life. That's what words can produce as their fruit. Death or life. That tells us it's serious. Look at Matthew chapter 12 and beginning in verse 36. So Matthew chapter 12, see the words of Jesus and what he says about words. Matthew chapter 12, and we'll begin in verse 36. But I say to you, so red letters in my Bible, I guess that means we ought to pay attention to them, but I say to you, that for every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. Are words important? It looks like it. Jesus says, by your words you'll be justified, accepted, made righteous, or alternatively, by your words, you will be condemned. Now, which would you rather be, justified or condemned? Are your words important? Yes. Is the power of life and death in your words? Yes. And looking again at verse 36, I say to you that for every idle word men may speak, they will have to give account of it. Well, what's an idle word? Well, the Greek gives a few other similar sort of synonyms. Non-working, inactive, useless. So you can think of that. For every useless, inactive, non-productive, empty, or idle is fairly good, I suppose, every idle, meaningless word that we may speak, we will give account of it in the day of judgment. Now, I think we all recognize that our world, our society, is full of useless words. TV, radio, obviously there's some good things on them, but there's also a huge amount of useless, idle, empty, vain, futile words. You know that for a fact. That surrounds us. Talk shows, texts, was it tweets? I mean, how many useless, pointless, vain, empty, inactive, idle words surround us every single day? And of course, we're not immune to that. So a question might be, well, okay, are our words productive? Are your words productive? If you're called to give account about your words, what you speak about, what you're saying, your words that you use from when you wake up to when you tumble into bed at night, your words, my words, how do they look? Idle? Are they words that produce life? Or words that produce death? Are they words that build up? Or words that tear down? What are they? And our words, of course, do demonstrate or allow us to see what's in our hearts, looking at the same chapter of Matthew, but backing up a few verses to verse 34. And we'll come back to this, I think, next week. But brood of vipers, says Jesus, talking to the Pharisees and so on. How can you, being evil, speak good things? So he's talking of speaking good things, for out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And that is a true statement. Out of the abundance, whatever fills your heart to overflowing, that is what you and I say. So when we hear our words, when God hears our words, when others hear our words, it's actually giving away, very often, what's in our heart. Because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Or I've often said, the mouth leaks. Because sometimes it's when we're not really paying attention, and we're not really focused on our words, and sometimes what's in our heart, it just, oops, leaks out. Verse 35, a good man, or woman, out of the good treasure of his heart, brings forth good things by saying. And an evil man, out of the evil treasure of his heart, brings forth evil things. We've commented in the past on the heart and mouth connection. That's it demonstrated here. The heart and the mouth are connected. What the mouth often talks, what the mouth often speaks or says, reveals what's in the heart. And an evil heart produces evil sayings, evil things, evil fruit, and ultimately, of course, death. Whereas a good heart produces a good fruit, a fruit that would lead to life. And of course, the question we've got is, what is our conversation? What do our words reveal about what's in our heart? Remember, death and life. And Jesus says here, again, just trying to reinforce the importance of our conversation, the importance of our words. Jesus said, verse 37, by your words, you'll be justified, or by your words, you'll be condemned. Life or death are in the power of our words. Jesus confirms that. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 1. Find Psalms and Proverbs, and then comes Ecclesiastes chapter 5. That's page 661 in my Bible, if that helps. There was one lady who used to listen in who had the same sort of version of the Bible as I used, so she was always very appreciative of the page number. Particularly some of the more obscure sort of books, you know, Habakkuk chapter 5 and so on, and Hezekiah chapter 18, those ones. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 1. Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know what they do evil. Of course, the sacrifice, we can sacrifice to God with praise. That mentions that way back in our Hebrews, that the praise of our lips can be a sacrifice to God. But it says here, essentially, verse 1, that when we go to the house of God and draw near, we should be more hearing, more listening, and whether it's the physical sacrifice or whether it's a sacrifice of a fool with his empty words, it says they do not know they do evil, but verse 2, do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, and you on earth, therefore let your words be few. So it says, don't be rash. One translation says, don't be hasty in word or impulsive in thought. Be careful. Let's say, guard your lips. When you go to the house of God, guard your lips. And it means that, in a sense, it implies more than just at the house of God, but that's a particular place when you're communing with God, when you're spending time with God. Be careful what you say. It says, verse 2, do not be rash with your mouth. Let not your heart utter anything hastily, especially before God. For God is in heaven, you on earth, therefore let your words be few. Let them be carefully chosen, carefully selected. Verse 4, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. It is better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Oh, didn't mean that. It was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? The principle being brought out here is, say what you mean and do it. Don't make a vow to God. Don't make any promise to God. Don't make any commitment to God with your words and then fail to deliver. It says that God is not pleased by that. He wants us to use our words properly. He's not impressed by idle words, inactive words, non-productive words. And here it makes it very plain that when you and I are, and particularly are talking to God, dealing with God, it says, going to the house of God, let your words be few. Don't be rash with your mouth. Don't jump and start saying things. Be careful. If you make any commitment, you better deliver it, because God is not impressed by idle words, by cheap talk, by meaningless statements. And the general principle is that no matter what you and I are up to, we should be a people who say what we mean, and then we do it. Empty talk, empty promises, boastful statements, and abject failure to deliver is bad character. It's not impressive at all. And of course, if we're saying things and not delivering, then we're creating a problem. We're not faithful. Let's turn to Psalms 15 and beginning in verse 1. So hopefully the importance of our words, being careful of them, and recognizing that life and death and blessing and cursing are involved, that we should be people who are very interested in ensuring that our words are good words, and that we're very careful what we say, and very careful that if we make any commitments, especially to our God, that we deliver on them, even if it's to our own hurt, which comes up in Psalms 15. Psalms 15, I think we were here last week, verse 1, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle, who may dwell in your holy hill? And we want to know the answer. Who are these people who can dwell with God? Who are these people who can live with the Father? Who are those who can dwell in God's holy tabernacle? Who are they? What are their characteristics? Verse 2, the answer is, he who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. Now there's the speaking and the heart connection again. This person speaks what is true. And speaking what is true is good. Speaking deceit is not good. This person speaks the truth in his heart. He does not backbite with his tongue. Now, we'll see increasingly that how we use our tongues is very important. And I hear, you know, people who backbite, people who are condemnatory, who are critical, the old gossip problem, that's not what God gave us our tongues for. That's leading to death and not to life. He who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend, and that would typically be by words, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. But like Ecclesiastes, this person keeps his or her word, even if it costs them, because their word is important. Their word is good. You can depend on their word. And if you think about it, God's word is important to us because we know it's dependable, it's reliable, it's forever settled in heaven. God's word does not change. God cannot lie. And you and I, as followers of God, ought to have the same characteristics, one of which is that if we have made a commitment, well, we should think first, of course, and possibly think again, and maybe even think again. But once we've made a commitment, once we've said something, we'll do something, then the man or woman who dwells in God's tabernacle is the person who swears to his own hurt and doesn't change. They are that reliable. He who does not pay out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. So we want our word to be good, dependable, not inactive, inoperative, idle, and useless. And God's looking for people whose word is good, who speak the truth in their heart, who don't backbite and condemn, whose words aren't destructive words, harmful words, injurious words. Look at Psalms 34 and verse 11. Psalms 34. And verse 11, of course, we talk all day long, pretty much. So we've got plenty of opportunity to test our words and to ensure that they are words that lead and tend to life and not the other way. Verse 11 of Psalms 34. Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Eternal. Who is the man who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Well, who is that person who desires life? Do you desire life? Would you like many days that you can see good in? Think I would. Think most of us would. We desire life. We want life abundantly. And we want many days, not many days of, you know, abject poverty, and many days of struggling, and many days of suffering, and many days of seeing grim things around us. But it says here, who loves, or who's the man who wants many days that he may see good? Well, we all do. Verse 13. Okay, here's one of the ways. Keep your tongue from evil, and your lips from speaking guile. That's the first thing he mentions. You want to live a long time? You want to enjoy good over those days? You desire life and life abundantly? Okay, keep your tongue from evil. Keep your lips from speaking guile, which is another word for deceit. You know, saying one thing and meaning another. Exaggerating. Posturing. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Eternal are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. So if we're living that way of life, then God's eyes are upon us and his ears are attentive to us, if we keep our tongue from evil and our lips from speaking guile. The verse 12, it says, who is the man who desires life? I've mentioned this before. This is an interesting character in this Jewish world. He lived, I think, sort of mid-1800s or early 1800s to, I think, the early 1900s. Nearly 100 years old when he died, so I guess he sort of rather proves his own point. But he wrote a number of sort of volumes of advice, guidance, instruction to the Jewish people about their words, about how they spoke, about how they should avoid exaggeration and deceit and guile and lying, how they should avoid evil words, how they should instruct themselves in speaking what is right and proper and pure. And he wrote a massive amount about that. And he had a nickname, and it's actually based on this verse here. It says, "Who is the man who desires life?" The Hebrew, in English letters, we'd write it as a Chofetz Chaim, which would be C-H-O-F-E-T-Z, Chofetz. Chaim would be C-H-A-I-M, Chofetz Chaim. That is the Hebrew for one who desires life. Like it says here in verse 12, "Who is the man who desires life?" So he was nicknamed the Chofetz Chaim. And he wrote all this material about, basically, how the scriptures from Genesis to Malachi instruct us in how to choose our words carefully, how we should be honest and true and shun deceit and gossip and backbiting and all the rest of it. So he spent a lot of time and wrote a massive amount about having good words. And I guess because he was nearly 100 when he died, I guess in a sense he did enjoy life and many days. But there's a key there, verse 13, "Keep your tongue from evil, keep your lips from speaking guile." That's something that we can do if we want to enjoy a good life, if we want to have good fruit. Remember, those who rule their tongue will eat the fruit thereof, but we want good fruit. We want happiness and joy. We want wisdom. We want a long life. We want friends. All the good things come from guarding our lips, choosing our words carefully. Look at Psalms 39 and verse 1. Psalms 39 and verse 1. David here says, "I said, I will guard my ways, lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle, while the wicked are before me." Well, okay, in the presence of the wicked, fine, but equally, generally speaking, restrain your mouth with a muzzle, or like a bridle. That's what the King James says. Guard our ways, lest we sin with our tongue. And David says, "I'll restrain my mouth. I will control my mouth as with a muzzle," meaning to be alert. Don't just open your mouth and start rattling away. Our words are important. They can influence us. They can influence the lives of others. There is a time that you and I need to restrain our lips as with a muzzle. The old saying is to engage the brain, before operating the mouth. Restraint. Self-control, not being too hasty with our words, rattling away, saying things that actually aren't conducive to life and building up and encouragement and pure and right in God's sight, but words that are cheap and tacky and nasty and harmful and destructive and pull down and degrade. Those aren't the words that ought to come out of the mouth of a human being made in the image and likeness of God. Look at Proverbs chapter 29. Proverbs 29 and verse 20. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 20. "Do you see a man hasty in his words? There's more hope for a fool than for such a man." Doesn't say he is a fool. He says that there's more chance of a fool having a successful life than a man or a woman, I guess, hasty in his words. Hasty is rash. Remember Ecclesiastes said, don't let your words be rash when you go to the house of God. You and I do need to be watchful of our words. Don't be so hasty. Engage the brain. Take time. Is this right to say? Do I select my words carefully here, or just rattle off and I'll think about it later? That's often what we do, but that's not the best way to do it. And of course, sometimes the vocabulary of silence is the wiser option. You know, most of us heard growing up from our parents things like, if you can't say anything good, don't say anything at all. Well, that's actually quite good advice, because the wrong words, wrongly spoken at the wrong time, words uttered hastily, impulsively, sometimes there's no going back. You know, it's too late. The words are out, the damage is done. Sometimes, of course, we're damaging ourselves, because what we say to ourselves has an effect. It's not just a question of what we say might encourage or depress another person. What we say can actually harm ourselves. We have to be very careful about our words. And it says here, if you see a person hasty, reckless in their words, just letting it all blurt out, well, there's more chance of a fool becoming a successful person than there is of that hasty person succeeding in life. It's basically their disaster area, and you and I do not want to be in that category. So being hasty of lip, not a good idea. Look at Proverbs 15 and verse 4. Here we read Proverbs 15 and verse 4. A wholesome tongue is a tree of life, but perverseness in it breaks the spirit. You know, a wholesome tongue is what? A tree of life? A good tongue? A tongue that speaks good things, wholesome things, building things, encouraging things, which speaks the truth, which speaks of what's honorable and noble. A wholesome tongue is a tree of life. What does a tree of life do? Well, a tree of life was in paradise, provided access, if you wanted it, to everlasting life. So a wholesome tongue, a good tongue, a person who chooses their words wisely to build up and to encourage, words which are noble and true and honest and decent, that type of tongue is life-giving. Oh, death and life are in the power of the tongue. But perverseness in the tongue breaks the spirit. You know, that is harmful. It's destructive. A perverse or twisted spirit harms people and actually ourselves. It breaks the spirit. You know, parents can do that sometimes unthinkingly. You know, to the children, you're no good. You're absolutely hopeless. You don't amount to nothing at school. You're just like your father. Other encouraging comments like that. And some kids, of course, are just bounces off them. But others, it breaks the spirit. And those children never recover, and their entire lives, and when they get married, their married lives are all affected by perverse speech, perverse tongue of their parents decades earlier. But on the other hand, a wholesome tongue, you know, to children, is a tree of life. Builds up, encourages. You can do that. Yeah, you can do that. Go for it. Building up or tearing down. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it or rule over it will eat the fruit thereof. Whilst we're in chapter 15, look at just verse 1 and 2. Be ashamed to miss this one. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Again, you know, when we're in conversation, if irritation, anger or wrath is starting to develop, a soft answer can calm that down. Whereas you can throw some more fuel in the fire, can't you? And that's not wise. They have tested this years and years ago in an experiment, because talking probably about choosing here, if you like, soft words, calming words. But they actually tried it on some telephone calls where people were phoning in, complaining and getting very agitated and angry and shouting. And the people who were picking up the calls have been taught to speak in a softer voice. So the person phones up and they're irate because their washing machine's turned up late or not at all, whatever it might be, or it's broken yet again, and is this a noisy shouting, and the recipient listens attentively but speaks back very softly. And strangely enough, they found that in most cases it calmed the other party down. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word, how dare you speak to me like that? And then, of course, things start to battle and escalates and so on, and that doesn't help. The tongue of the wise, verse 2, uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. I think the Hebrew implies belches. You know, the mouth of an idiot just lets it all come out. But the wise person, they use their tongue wisely, properly, and a soft answer turns away wrath. So it's important that you and I, not just conscious, aware of the impact of our tongues. We'll continue to see later, the heart-mouth connection, and the words that we speak do reveal what's in our heart. We saw that earlier. And equally, if you're looking at faith, working faith, well, first of all, you have to believe in your heart, and you speak the words of faith. And we've covered that in other messages, that you believe in the heart, you speak with the mouth, and then things happen. You can see an example way back in Numbers 13 of the danger of loose lips. Numbers 13 and verse 30. If these people had guarded their lips, not been hasty before God, things might have ended very differently, but this is what did happen. Numbers 13 and verse 30, you remember that 12 spies had gone out from Moses to spy out the promised land, and they'd come back with some goodies, but also a rather mixed story. 10 had one version of the story, and Joshua and Caleb had another version. But picking up in verse 30, then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. Yeah, let's go. It's ours. Let's take it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. This was the 10 spies. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. Giants, huge, intimidating. Verse 33, there we saw the giants. The descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. So they brought back a bad report. By the way, what's a bad report? Words. They brought back words. Were these words of life? Of encouragement? Words of faith? Did these words lift up the people to go and possess the land flowing with milk and honey that God had promised? Or did these words discourage? Produce fear and anxiety? Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and there's lots of death coming out of these guys' tongues. Chapter 14, verse 1, then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And that's the impact of those words. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness. Big mistake. If only we had died. Are words important? Do words lift up? Pull down? Is death and life in the power of the tongue? What we believe in our heart, we say with our mouth. If only we had died in this wilderness. That's what they said. Should they have said that? No. Are these things written down for our admonition? Yes. Did God hear what they said? Yep. he did, and he wasn't pleased. And then things started to get very badly wrong for the Israelites, and Moses intervened because God was minded to virtually wipe them out. And Moses said, please don't, and God said, I'll hear you, Moses. Let's drop down to verse 26. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who murmur against me? I have heard the murmurings which the children of Israel murmur against me. Because, see, God hears. He heard them all, right? Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. Just as you have spoken, I will do. In a sense, they'd pronounced their own sentence. What they believed in their heart, we're going to die in the wilderness. What they said with their mouth, we're going to die in the wilderness. And that's precisely what came to pass. Just as you have said, so you will get. Remember Ecclesiastes 5:2? Don't turn there, but what it said was, do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, and you in earth, and therefore let your words be few. They didn't. They opened their mouth and they said things which were harmful and injurious and plain wrong and provocative, and they got what they said. They said, we're going to die in the wilderness, and of course, you know, they did die in the wilderness. Verse 29, the carcasses of you who have murmured against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who are numbered according to your entire number, from 20 years old and above, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. You shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in. But your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I will bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness. Is death and life in the power of the tongue? Well, absolutely. They were the evidence of that. They all died due to what they said, and of course that revealed fundamentally what was in their heart. And you know, what scared them a lot there was the giants, the warriors, the fortified cities, and the fact they did not really believe in God, and they spoke words of death. There's an opposite example we can look at. We turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17. We turn to 1 Samuel 17 and verse 3. There's a similar sort of scenario, vaguely, but a very different outcome. 1 Samuel 17, that's the story of David and Goliath. I'm picking up in verse 3. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side with a valley between them, and a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. And nobody's too sure, I think, exactly how big a cubit was, but it could be a sort of shorter cubit or a longer cubit. It appears to be that Goliath was either at the shorter end, about 9'6", or his higher end, about 11'10". Well, either way, he's a big lad. And he's not only a big lad, it says verse 5, he had a bronze helmet on his head, he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, which my margin says is 125 pounds of armour loaded on his body. And he had bronze greaves on his legs, and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels. That's 15 pounds. That's just the end of it. And the shield bearer went before him. This is one big beast out there. Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, why have you come out to line up for a battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. And he said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And when Saul and all Israel heard these words, they were dismayed and greatly fret, and went hiding, you know, under bushels and things, because this was one mean hombre, and they did not want to tangle with him. Okay, well, a bit like ancient Israel, you know, all those giants in the land, and they were afraid. But there's a slight change in the story here, because verse 32, if we drop down, then David, who had been brought to Saul, said, let no man's heart fail him because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you're but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went after it and struck it, and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard, and struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. But notice, verse 37, moreover, David said, the Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, well, go on then. So David, unlike ancient Israel at the border of the Promised Land, said, God will deliver us. He may be a giant, there may be fortified cities, he may be armored. God will deliver me. I will succeed. So very different response, but the words are different, aren't they? Ancient Israel, oh, we're going to die in this wilderness. Why is God prepared to kill us in the wilderness? We're going to die here and our children are going to die here. David's words are, I'll fight, God will deliver. Look at verse 43. So David's run up now at this point with his sling, and the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come on, I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, with a spear, with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled. This day, now this is good words, these are words of faith, words of life, well, maybe not for Goliath, they are for David. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you, and this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not say with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. And we know the rest of the story. But there's a similar sort of environment. Giant or giants, the people of Israel, there were as one lot, feared in their hearts, spoke words of fear, words of unbelief, words of death. David was very different. He believed God, he trusted God, and he spoke words of life, and God honored David's faith. He heard his words, and you and I need to be aware that God hears our words, because again, these things are written for our admonition. Let's look at James chapter 3 and verse 1. James chapter 3, first verse. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment, because the words that our teacher speaks can affect dozens or hundreds or thousands of people. So he can influence for good or, you know, for bad. Let's be very careful, therefore, what he says. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body, if we can control our words. You know, this is something to aim at. A person who does not offend, does not err, does not make mistakes, does not stumble in word. Do you? Do I will? Certainly, we are human, so we do err from time to time. But if we can control our words, control our tongues, then we are a perfect man, it says. Indeed, verse 3, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. You control a horse's mouth, you control his body. Go to the starboard, or left, where it is with horses, and off they go. Verse 4, we look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. It's a little thing controls a huge ship. A little, you know, mouth, a little bit in the horse's mouth controls a great big lumbering car horse. Even so, the tongue is a little member, verse 5, and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. A little tiny, you know, fire from a discarded cigarette or matchstick or something can cause a blaze across a huge forest. A little tongue in our mouth can cause a huge amount of destruction. Verse 6, and the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell. Certainly some interesting pictures there of just how dangerous a tongue can be. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no man can tame the tongue. I take this to be no unconverted man, because you and I with the Spirit of God can tame the tongue. God's Spirit in us can help us control and exert discipline on the tongue, but certainly unconverted people can't. It says, verse 8, no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison, which is why we have to control it. Just let the tongue waggle, do stuff, and it's like a poisonous serpent. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. You know, James, how can you do this? How can you bless God with your tongue, saying good words about God, and at the same time use the same tongue to say bad words and evil words about your own brethren? Shouldn't happen. Verse 11, does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? No. Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? No. Thus no spring can yield both salt water and fresh, and James means our tongue should be pure. We should not be, you know, speaking at the same mouth blessings and cursings. And talking of cursings here, James doesn't primarily mean bad language and four letter words. He's talking about to curse in the sense of to devote to destruction by your words. To bless is to assign favor to somebody by words. So again, to curse is to devote to destruction by the words that we speak, and to bless is to assign favor to somebody by the words that we speak. Look at Mark chapter 11 and verse 12. We see Jesus cursing something, because you and I can do good or we can do harm by our words. We have to be very careful. That's what James is getting at. Be very careful. You are not supposed to be cursing other people, devoting them to destruction by your words. In Mark chapter 11 and verse 12, pick up the story in verse 12. This is Jesus and the fig tree, so I think you know where we're going. Now the next day, when they had come out from Bethany, Jesus was hungry, and seeing from afar a fig tree having leaves, he went to see if perhaps he would find something on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. In response, Jesus said to it, oh, Jesus is speaking to a tree. Oh, I'd never do that, you might say. This is why we don't get the same results that Jesus got. But words are important. Here's Jesus speaking words even to a tree. Jesus said to it, let no one eat fruit from you ever again. And his disciples heard it. Now that's a curse. Jesus has just devoted the tree to destruction. He's assigned it to destruction. You will never again bear fruit. Words spoken, a curse upon the tree. Dropping down to verse 20. Now in the morning as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. And Peter, remembering, said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered away. The tree you devoted to destruction has withered away. Jesus spoke words of harm and injury on that tree, because it was a corrupt tree. That's what a curse is. Carrying on. So Jesus answered and said to them, have faith in God, or have the faith of God. For assuredly I say to you, whoever, that would by the way include you and me, whoever says, oh, to this mountain, excuse me, is Jesus saying that you and I should be speaking to a mountain? Words, taking our words that can influence and can produce life and death, and our words we can address to a mountain or to a tree. That's exactly what Jesus is saying. Whoever says to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart. See, that's where the other part is, heart and mouth connection. No doubt, but I believe in your heart, speak with your mouth, but carrying on. For assuredly I say to you, whoever says this mountain be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes in his heart that those things he says will come to pass, he will have whatever he says. If he believes in his heart and speaks to the mountain, he will have whatever he says. You don't say it, you don't get it. It's not thinking, it's not praying to God to move the mountain. It's believing in your heart and speaking words to the mountain. Then you will get what you say. Verse 24, therefore I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you receive them and you will have them. We'll come back to that passage next week. But notice, Jesus is clearly teaching this, I think, in a positive sense. If you want something bad to move, some obstacle in your life, we'll speak to it. Don't speak to God and ask him to move it. You know, you and I speak to it, and provided we believe in our heart, then job done. But equally, this can apply in a negative sense. If you believe bad in your heart and say it, you're in danger of having whatever you say. Bad things that you believe in your heart, you know, you might say things like, I've just heard in the news that the swine flu is coming. I know I'll be the first to get it in our family, and it'll last the longest in my body. I'll nearly die, I'm bound to. I nearly died last year from the swine flu. Well, of course, if you believe in your heart, and speaking to this mountain of flu, and say, come and get me, or maybe give the recession, well, there's rumours of redundancy, and I'm going to be the first one to lose my job, and the last one to get another job. Well, or Israel. You know, we're going to die out here in the wilderness. We know that. We believe that. We're going to die. They got just what they said. So we've got to be very careful. The scriptures illustrate how powerful our words are. Our words can move mountains. And we still have to take care not to harm others by our words. In effect, we may not see it as cursing them, but if our words are negative, harmful, injurious, we're in danger of cursing other people. It's not our intention. Look at Genesis chapter 27 and verse 1. We can see how blessings can be produced with our words. Genesis chapter 27 and verse 1. Talking here of Isaac, Esau, Jacob. Genesis 27 and verse 1. Now it came to pass when Isaac was old and his eyes were so dim that he could not see, that he called Esau his older son and said to him, "My son." He answered him, "Here I am." He said, "Behold, now I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now therefore, please take your weapons, your quiver and your bow. Go out to the field and hunt game for me, and make me savory food, such as I love, and bring it to me, that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." See, blessing is bestowing favor on someone with our words. And Isaac wanted to bestow very important favors and graces on his son. But you know the story. Jacob and his mum contrived to dress him up in goatskins and hairy garments and, pass him off as Esau. Drop me down to verse 22. So Jacob, disguised in his goatskins, went near to Isaac, his father, and he felt him and said, "Well, strange, the voice is Jacob's, but the hands are the hands of Esau." There's a great hairy mittens he was wearing. And he did not recognize him, because his hands were hairy, like his brother Esau's hands, so he blessed him. And he said, "Are you really my son Esau?" "Yes," he said, "I am." He was telling Porky's. But he said, "Bring it dear to me, and I will eat of my son's game, so that my soul may bless you." So he brought it near to him, and he ate. And he brought him wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near now and kiss me, my son." And he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his clothing, and blessed him. This is words bestowing favor. He blessed him and said, "Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore, may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine. Let peoples serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you." Now those were blessings of prosperity, of national greatness, and that wealth and prosperity was passed on legally, formally, by words. Words actually have a real, proper, genuine, not imaginary effect. Of course, minutes later, poor old Isaac arrives in the scene. I pick up the story in verse 31. He also made savory food and brought it to his father and said to his father, "Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that your soul may bless me." And his father Isaac said to him, "Hey, who are you?" He said, "Well, I'm your son, your firstborn, Esau." Then Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, "Who? Well, where's the one who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before you came, and I have blessed him. And indeed, he shall be blessed." It's done. It's irrevocable. When Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, my father." But he said, "Your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing." And there's no way back. Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now look, he has taken away my blessing." And he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Indeed, I have made him your master, and all his brethren I have given to him as servants. With grain and wine I have sustained him. What shall I do for you now, my son?" And the principle is, you can't take back your words very easily. Once uttered, good or bad, it's often done. The consequences are on the way. The fruit of your lips has been released. Isaac couldn't take it back, because our words, you see, are important. These were not idle words, inactive words, useless words. These were words conveying and assigning favor. And you have to be careful. You know, we can bless with our words, and that's a lot better than cursing, especially around our families. You remember the time when Jesus, they brought children to Jesus, little children. The disciples were sort of keen to sort of push him away and say, he's far too busy. He said, no, let little children come to me. And it says Jesus took them in his hands and he blessed them. Well, that wasn't just some platitude, like some Catholic nun or priest waving their arms around, sprinkling water over a child. This was genuine. Jesus was imparting favor to these children with his words, his blessing. There's an interesting illustration of the importance of words way back in Numbers chapter 20, in the life of Moses. We turn by there, Numbers 20, and verse 2. Numbers 20 and verse 2. Now there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. Usual trouble from the murmuring Israelites. So Moses and Aaron went to God for guidance, and dropping down to verse 7. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, and gather the assembly together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. So Jesus said, speak to the mountain, if you believe in your heart, and it will move. Here, 2,000 years earlier, or 1,500 years earlier, God says, speak to the rock, Moses, and it will yield his water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock, and give drink to the congregation and their animals. Well, that's fairly straightforward. Certainly illustrates the importance and the impact of words. Speak to the rock. Wow, speak to the rock that's going to produce water. Wow, wait to see that happen. But unfortunately, things went wrong. And for once, Moses was rather disobedient. Verse 9. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. That's instruction 1. Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock. So far so good. And he said to them, hear now you rebels. Oops. This is what they call improvisation. And it's also deviating from instructions from God. And this is getting off the path. Hear now you rebels. Not a good idea this. Must we bring water for you out of the rock? Who's the we, by the way? Aaron and Moses? And then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. Oops. That wasn't in the instructions. Why did he strike twice? Well, maybe the first time nothing happened. After all, God says, speak to the rock. I don't give water. Moses bounces his rod off the rock and oop, nothing's happened. And he bounces again off the rock, and maybe God was merciful to Moses not to embarrass him too much, but that was wrong. Speak to the rock, use your words on the rock, honor me. So Moses bounced the rod twice off the rock, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe me. Oh. So does that mean that Moses couldn't see how you could speak to a rock and it gives water? You see, words of faith, you and I have to believe in our hearts and speak to the mountain. It looks like Moses couldn't quite see that. It says, you didn't believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel. Therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. This was the water of Meribah, because the children of Israel contended with the Lord and he was hallowed among them. So it looks like Moses didn't believe his words could produce water from the rock. So he relied on his strength and the physical effort and didn't follow God's instructions. Now, principle there, if you and I choose to deviate from God's instructions, what can we expect? Just because we're the called, we're the saints, we're the church of God, doesn't mean we can get away with ignoring and transgressing God's instructions. Moses couldn't. He's probably a bit further ahead than you and I are. But God said, do this. Where did you come from doing that? And to say, you rebels, that was not Moses' place. Look at Psalms 106 and verse 32 to see one other aspect of this example of Moses. Psalms 106 and verse 32. Psalms 106, verse 32. Psalms 106 is all about the history of Israel coming out of Egypt and through the Red Sea and so on. And then dropping down to verse 32. They angered him, that was God also, the waters of strife, or Meribah, that's the part we just read there, Numbers chapter 20. They certainly angered God there by complaining yet again about, there's no water, there's no beef burgers, terrible out here. So they went ill with Moses on account of them. Verse 33, because they rebelled against his spirit, talking of Moses, I think, so that he spoke rashly with his lips. Moses should have known better. You and I, by the way, should know better. Again, don't speak rashly, don't speak hastily, let your words be few. Words can lead to life, words can lead to death. I'm sure verse 33 has got capital his spirit in my New King James. I think it's talking of Moses. He just provoked the poor guy. You know, he dealt with them for quite a long time. They never stopped complaining and whinging and moaning and murmuring. But nonetheless, that didn't excuse Moses' behavior. God said, speak to the rock. You know, believe and speak. And he did not. He said, oh, you rebels, shall we bring the water out for you? Bang, bang, bang. Or actually just bang bang as it happens. So verse 33 says, because they rebelled against his spirit, so that he spoke rashly with his lips. I think one translation says unadvisedly. So the lesson for you and I is hopefully fairly clear. We've got to be very careful with our words. And certainly don't be hasty with our words. And remember that there are some extremes. Let's turn back in conclusion to Proverbs 18:21. I think that's where we started. Proverbs 18:21, and we'll continue this next week, God willing. Proverbs 18:21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it or rule over it will eat its fruit. Death and life. It really is potentially as extreme as that, and all parts in between. You can use, it's our choice really. We pretty much control our own tongues, our own mouths. It's our choice. Your choice whether we use our tongues to produce the fruit of life or to produce the fruit of death. Your choice. My choice. But hopefully we've seen today at least a few places that our words are very important. Our words are very influential. Our words can build up, can destroy, can produce life, and can produce death. So as the title of the message was, guard your lips. With that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.